Welcome to People More Interesting Than Me, the podcast, where I step back and let fascinating individuals take the spotlight. Join me as I sit down with incredible guests who captivate and inspire, showcasing their stories, experiences, and wisdom that make them truly extraordinary. Tune in for engaging conversations that'll leave you enlightened and entertained. I mean, at least I'm entertained. This week, we have the privilege of sitting down with remarkable Alan Questill. Alan is a beacon of clarity, creativity, and compassion in the world of teaching. Alan has dedicated his life to sharing his profound understanding of movement, creativity, and kindness with thousands of people across the globe. Known for his down-to-earth style and gentle human perspective, Alan creates vibrant learning environments wherever he goes. From bustling cities to remote corners of the world, he has touched the lives of students of five continents in over 20 countries. Alan's work extends far beyond the confines of traditional teaching. Join us as we explore the depths of Alan's wisdom, humor, and profound insights. Get ready to be inspired, challenged, and moved by this extraordinary individual on People More Interesting Than Me. Enjoy. But let's dig in, I guess. Tell us a little bit, me and the listeners, about yourself.
Okay, so I would say that my major job, although it's not really explicit in the way it's presented, is that I help people like themselves more. And my kind of full-time job, that's the forum where I can explore that largely, is I teach the Feldenkrais method, which is a movement technique based on learning theories. And I work with people with orthopedic problems, neurological problems, professional actors, athletes, dancers, people who are interested in getting better at something or just trying to change their self-image. And I have now at this point a smaller private practice, but I spend most of my time teaching people to become Feldenkrais practitioners. And before that, I was an actor. And actually, when I discovered Feldenkrais, I thought, oh, here's something I could do part-time and pursue acting. But I got so involved with Feldenkrais and it just took over. And I've written one book on creativity that was originally about acting, and I decided to broaden it out. And it's all based on the Feldenkrais method, actually. And even the whole idea of liking ourselves more came out of a Feldenkrais workshop I was creating on self-image. And as I examined self-image, I started to think more and more that it was a reflection of how much we like ourselves or how much we don't like ourselves. So if I like myself, I have a good self-image. If I don't like myself, I don't have such a great self-image. And then after some time, I started to think, well, this is my job, to help people like themselves more. And in Feldenkrais, there are two modalities. One's hands-on, where I work with someone fully clothed on a low table, and it's really tailor-made for that individual and their needs. And then out of that came another modality called awareness through movement, which is taught to groups. Thinking's the same behind it, and that brings about changes in breathing, posture, reduction or elimination of pain, changes in self-image. And the movements, it's very different than any movement modality that I'm aware of at this point still, in that you're doing movements really slow and small, so that when you're doing the movement, your attention can wander through the rest of yourself to discover how the rest of you is involved. And part of that is always reminding people to go slower, smaller. And then as part of this idea of liking ourselves more, I started to say, can you move in a way that you like the way it feels? And it's interesting how when I say that, how it changes the quality of movement in so many people. And for me, one of the interesting things about that is that it's like entering ourselves through the back door. Because the movements, they have some value, of course, but they're not like life-changing things of important things like every day, like a job or a home or something like that. And so it builds slowly from behind until over time, people have actually said to me, you know, I like myself more. And it's not based on external things. It's something that's always possible for all of us at every moment.
So just first thought that comes into my mind, how do you deal with people? And I always like to play devil's advocate. Like, for example, I always use my dad as an example, but you say what you know. Like, how would you break people out of the shell? Like, for example, my dad would say something. My dad's his dad died at the age of 21, for example. And one time I asked him, like, how did that make you feel? Mm-hmm. And he's like, I don't want to talk about that. Like, that's such a like a bad time in my life. How do you get people that, you know, like shut down, stuff like that, get themselves to open up? Because the way you explain it, it's, I mean, it makes total sense, but what it sounds like is being intentional. How do you get people to be intentional who their whole life, you know, they have so many barriers up that it's like, I don't want to like, I don't want to get any flack from this, but it seems like a generational thing. It was a different time, so they had different resources and tools to deal with stuff, and it's just, you know, worn down. Like, how do you deal with people who have just so much, you know, baggage or tendencies like that?
I kind of make an assumption that we all have baggage, and some maybe it's more apparent than others, but in some ways I know I have baggage. I imagine you do too. I'm not generally in a verbal conversation to investigate these kind of things. As I said before, that the vehicle that I do it through is movement. And so that people, and now the quality of the movements that I ask people to do, they're not just random movements, they're structured. So they often lead to improvement in ability, to an overall generalized feeling of higher quality of how someone feels, so that I would say like 99% of the time, people feel better. And if they have that as a context, that's one thing. Now, the other thing that's more of a challenge is that the person has to want it. If they're not really, if I'm trying to talk someone into something, it could go easily, but it could very often be an uphill battle. So I don't spend my time trying to convince someone of the value of something. It's better if I can demonstrate the value to them to at least make them go, make them think about it a little bit more, to think, well, maybe this isn't something I know. And in terms of like making it intentional, like you said, it's like, that's a want, you know, but there has to be a benefit for someone to want to pursue something. Otherwise, I'm talking to air, you know. So when I explain what I do to someone in more depth, right, that if I'm explaining it well, they'll ask me more questions. And if I'm not explaining it well, or if it's not interesting to them, which I see, is their eyes just glaze over. And at that point, I stop talking. I've learned to not try to get them interested. And the last thing I would say about meeting someone who has baggage, let's say, is to be able to listen to them. So instead of presenting everything from what I want to say and my point of view, asking them more questions, finding out their needs, their interests, things like that. Because I think when someone is really being listened to, they feel safer. They feel more open to things. That invites a connection, which is probably the most basic way we can talk about any of this, is how can we feel connected with ourselves and with others too?
No, that's a great answer. So switching to, I guess, the other, other side of, I guess, the age group. So in obviously in the last 5 or 10 years, social media has taken a huge boom. And when I was thinking about, this interview, two spectrums I kind of thought of, which I never really thought of, with this new generation, obviously mental health is huge. Like everyone is more conscious. Therapy is kind of like a, it's not a taboo like it used to be. Like people like, oh, she's going to therapy. She's great. That was like commonplace when I was like in middle school and high school. People thought that, especially with children going to therapy. But nowadays it's more, you know, like going to the dentist. Yeah. But on the other side of the coin, obviously, is social media. With social media, I feel like people are more, I got to have it now, or they're comparing themselves to, you know, like 20 different people who are, you know, in layers of makeup and like, how do you try to find kindness in that type of environment? Obviously, mental health is, like I said, like a bigger key nowadays, but how do you fight that with all these people screaming in your ear?
So first of all, before I relate it to kindness, I think I'll start with relating it to liking ourselves more, because you expressed it really well when you talked about how people compare themselves, you know, and if you think of it, you know, a self-image for a child can form fairly young. But the self-image, as most of us experience it as adults, it forms when the child all of a sudden starts comparing themselves to others. It's different than wanting what the other child has. That's an approximation of it. But the minute we start comparing ourselves to others, very few people at a young age compare themselves to someone who's less than them. They always compare themselves to someone who they think is more than them. And so it's very unsatisfying, and it brings about a state of, like, for example, in any context that I teach in, I'll ask the group, if I'll start talking about liking yourself more, and I'll say, is there anyone here who doesn't want to like yourself more? And they all have this kind of sheepish grin, like, oh, yeah. Because one woman once said, I already like myself. And I said, great. But that wasn't the question. The question is, would you like to like yourself more? And she was like, okay, you know. Now, and then we have to examine, how do we go about liking ourselves more? Well, it's a haircut, clothing, house, a car, a partner. And those things are all reasonable. They work, but they're temporary. None of them are sustained in any way. I think a good example is, like, I don't know if you've ever had the opportunity to get a new car. You get a new car and you drive around and you're feeling pretty damn good. And you see the older versions of that car and you kind of, ha ha, look at me, you know? And so it's a real attitude thing that's based on an external thing. And that lasts for how long? 1 year. Because in the next year, the new model comes out. And now you're in the back seat, right? And the other guy's looking at you. And so, and look, I mean, just Facebook, which a lot of people are leaving, of course, but the idea of how many likes are there, right? Like, that's somehow equal to our value, that if I get more likes, and I have that. I have one page on Facebook called Like Yourself More, where I post things every day, things that make you smile. And if I get a lot of hits, I feel great. And, you know, part of me goes, who cares? What does that have to do? So I would say that one of the things that someone younger can do is to look at their immediate circle of friends and family and say, if I just lived within this circle of people, could I be satisfied? Because those other things, as I find it, they produce either a temporary satisfaction or more often greater dissatisfaction. And then if I take that to kindness, well, there's a few things. There's being kind to others and being kind to ourselves. And I found for myself that being kind to others is often easier than being kind to myself. But let me step back a minute and say, so what's the point of being kind? Well, I mean, we all have an understanding that that's a good value and that people benefit from it. But I had an experience after I'd been working with this idea of liking ourselves more, where I did some small kind act to someone. And in the next moment, I thought, I like myself more. That doing something for another like that made me feel a little better about myself. And I'm not suggesting that we do a lot of acts of kindness so we can pat ourselves on the back, but that there's a value to acts of kindness, as you were saying earlier, like holding a door open for someone, right? Or just the bus is there and you hold the bus driver, wait, there's someone coming, you know, that those things, people respond to those things. Now that's being kind, and there's many other things I'll talk about if you want, but then there's the idea of being kind to ourselves. So when I started my book, Practice Intentional Acts of Kindness and Liking Yourself More, when I got to the part about being kind to ourselves, I got blocked for about 5 years. It shocked me because I'd already written notes. I had a lot of material and stuff. But when I really went into it, it was like, I think I don't understand this as well as I could. And so, like, you know, the phrase, do unto others as you would do unto yourself, right? But then there's, if you flip that and said, do unto yourself as you would do unto others, it's hard, right? And so, you know, I think that everyone likes the idea of liking themselves more. Everyone likes the idea of being kinder. And I think it represents a certain level of challenge that to do that, it takes some work. It takes work and it takes a change in our self-image. Because even if we think we're kind, I'll give you an example, okay? So one of the acts of kindness, because I'm interested in the concrete things you can do. Yeah, compassion and empathy are significant, but if it isn't something you can practice easily and comfortably on a day-to-day basis, it's not going to stick. So one idea, after each chapter of my book, I have all these exercises. So on the one in generosity, I have this thing about tipping more, okay? And it's a thing, and it's always within your means. So like, you know, my average tip would have been 20% in a restaurant. And I make the suggestion, if you can do it, that for every $5 of tip, you give one more dollar. And, you know, if it's a $15 tip, $3 more, the server notices that, makes a difference to them. But here's the kicker. I was saying it's not so easy to do sometimes. So when I was writing that chapter, I went out to dinner with a couple of friends and I picked up the check. It was $70 and I tipped 20, so 20%, so I'll give $85. And then I thought, I'm going to give more. And I had a $100 bill in my pocket. And I thought, I'm going to give the $100. And then the next minute, I just clutched. I was like, oh, I can't do that. That's way too much. What am I thinking? You know? And then I went, what am I writing about here? And I gave it to the waitress. And when I left the restaurant, she came up to me and stopped me and said, you just made my night. Right? But I mean, that's one act of kindness. But the reason I'm telling the story is because it's challenging to do things like this. You know, it has to have the want, the intention to do it, to do something like that. And also, we have to be kind to ourselves when we drop the ball. When we go, oh, I could have done it then, I didn't do it then. Not beating myself up again and going into that, but saying, oh, you know, next time I'll do better. That was a long answer. Did that answer your question?
No, that's perfect. And it goes to one of the things that, Alan, like one of my, this isn't like a constant conversation, but it comes up, let's say like once every year or something like that with my wife. Because my wife is one of the most, she doesn't really listen to my podcast much, so this won't do me any good, but she's like one of the nicest, like caring people. And that's how she was raised. Uh-huh. But, and she's nice to other people, but I'd like to, like I said, I play devil's advocate. So I tell her, like, being nice to someone, like, for example, she's a teacher at school. And like, when people ask you about your children, they don't really, 9 times out of 10, especially if they don't have children, they don't really care. And this is going to sound sadistic on my side, but I never talk about my children at work because I don't like hearing about other people's kids, to be honest, unless I really care about the person.
Right, sure.
But, and I tell her, this is all transactional. Like, you telling someone about your kids, the only real time I would tell that to someone is if I know they care about their kids. So it's like you're swapping war stories. Right. And I tell her, doing a good turn for someone you do it like we really talked about it, that it's you're really just like you're saying, like making your yourself feel better about yourself. It's right. Transactional, like leaving, keeping that door open for someone. Like, for example, I like to do that. I wake up at 5 a.m. I'm not going to say every day. I try to, but it's not happening. And then at 6 a.m. when I leave where the fitness place I go to, like I try to leave the door open no matter what. Like if I have to wait 10 seconds, that's fine. But it makes me feel better, like starting my day. Like it's like one little thing. Obviously, I'm not a hero for keeping the door open, but like that little thing makes me feel better for the rest of the day. And that's obviously it's not free because I'm wasting a little bit of my time, but it's like a transactional thing and it makes me feel better. And that's what I try to tell her. I don't know if you see that same perspective, and it sounds like you might, that it is transactional, but you are getting in respects, like you're making yourself feel better, but you're also
doing something for someone else.
Yeah. And you don't know, the crazy thing that I've learned, especially from this podcast, is perspective is like the biggest thing in life. Because just like you were saying on the $30 tip on a $70 bill, you don't know how much your act of kindness like helped that waitress. Like it could have been like 10 times like it was for you to like receive that compliment from her. And that's the crazy thing. Like, what's that saying? Like the parts is greater. The sum is greater than the parts.
The sum is greater than the whole. Yeah.
And that's kind of, I mean, why people do parts is greater than
the whole is greater than its parts. That's what.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And I mean, that's why people keep going in life, because if it was what I put in, I'm going to get exactly what I get out. That's why people invest money. That's why people invest time, because they're hoping to get more out of it than they put in.
I think so too. And I think that, you know, from my point of view, well, let me take a turn here for just a moment and come back to it. So in the Feldenkrais method, Dr. Feldenkrais was a physicist, a mathematician, an engineer, one of the first Westerners to get a black belt in judo, a real Renaissance man. And I was fortunate to work with him in his last training. And when he thought about self-image, he thought our self-image was comprised of our thinking, our feeling, our sensing, and our movement, our actions. Our thinking in terms of the thoughts and the way we construct things like that, mostly in language. Our feelings in terms of our emotions, our sensations in terms of how we take in and process information from the world, and our actions. And he surmised, I think accurately, that a change in any one of those aspects has the potential to change the other aspects. If I change how I think, it can change how I feel. If I change how I move, it can change how I think, and so on. But the thing is, movement is the most immediate and concrete way in. And I would make a strong argument that it's one of the more fundal aspects of us biologically, all of us biologically. Like a single cell amoeba needs to be able to move towards nourishment or move away from danger. So movement is fundamental. And I would say that the idea of liking ourselves more is fundamental. I don't know anyone who goes to the gym or does yoga or practices Tai Chi or is studying an instrument or studying a language, that on some level that the approximations of success in that, they feel better about themselves. They like themselves more. And so when you talk about like your wife being kind to people, yourself opening and holding up the door, if we added more, and I'll tell you, the thing that I've found since I wrote the book is that I see more kindness around me than I ever saw before. And I'm kind of like, did I just not see this? I mean, I always saw kindness, that was clear. But it was like more and more, I'm like impressed with the world, right? And I also think we have a long way to go, you know? So yeah, it's something transactional in a sense. And well, here's another story like this. So there's a restaurant I go to a lot where I live in Santa Fe. And I leave a pretty big tip. And so when I first started doing that there, like the wait person never came back and like thanked me. And, you know, part of me went, oh, here I go again. More learning about myself that I need to separate this from any return that I might, any expectation of getting anything back. Well, it turns out they all share tips there, so I don't even think I even look at them, you know? So it's like, oh, of course, you know? But it put me in a few moments of feeling bad, judging them, all of this stuff that, and it's like, how do we do these actions cleanly, right? So the tipping is an example where it's in relation to another. Okay, that's something else. And there we have that kind of job, right? But when it's in relation to ourselves, what do we do? How do we acknowledge something like that? And I would describe it yet another way, excuse me, that I would say another way of describing a lot of what we're talking about is someone's capacity to listen. To listen without already trying to answer, you know, and to make it an intentional act when we can, right? So like, you know, you described at work or, you know, talking about your kids or not, or, and of course it makes sense if someone else has kids that they would be more interested in your story of the day, right? So maybe there's a way to flip that. Maybe there's a way to say, like, really, what's happening for you right now in your life? What's good, you know? And let them tell their story for the day. And hopefully, maybe, they'll say, and you? What's going on with you? Oh, let me tell you what my kid did today, right? And so then that's more, it's actually, I believe, less transactional and more sharing. So it's a sense of connection for something like that. Because if it's just transactional, then we're all giving to get. You know, and which is not bad. I'm not judging that in any way, but I'm saying that's a consideration for what's my motivation for doing the things that I'm doing, right? And I think it's a lifelong challenge. Like the idea of me liking myself more, which I've come to, right? I can say the next step is harder. To like myself more. What I need to do to get better from my point of view, the next step for me to be kinder is harder, you know? And that hopefully I have enough momentum already that I can go, okay, I'm going to do that. You know, that's something I want to do. I want to feel and make happen. And I also know that along the way, I'm going to have a lot of bumps and challenges. And encounters with parts of myself that I didn't even know were there, you know? And it's like, oh boy. It's like when I teach, right? So I teach groups of people, like the group I'm here right now in France teaching, is 40 some odd people in here. And, you know, I've taught for a long time and I'm teaching adults. I'm not teaching kids, right? And, you know, I've run into some real challenges with adults, you know? And every time I kind of navigate past a difficult situation, I get the feeling of, huh, good. Okay, I have more. I know how to do that better now. So if it comes again, I'm ready. But no matter how well I'm prepared, there's always something new that comes and bites me in the ass. And I'm like, oh, here I am again. But then I realize those are my best teachers. I'm not asking for more of that. You know, I have enough teachers, you know. But it's like, instead of getting annoyed or upset with the person, I go, oh, I have to listen better. I have to understand better. I have to help this person like themselves more. Now, that's my job. I'm not saying that's everyone's job, but to listen better. To like, here's another example. So you talk about holding the door. So I grew up in New York City, and you know, in my 20s, I was with my good friend, and we were in a bank. And he was in front of me. And when he got to the teller, he just said, so how's your day going? And the teller was like, what? She was shocked, you know? And she kind of got confused for a moment and then started to answer him. And he talked for a minute or two. And I said to him later, I said, where'd you learn that? And he grew up in the Bronx. It was like, you know, this is not a New Yorker kind of thing. And so I talk about something called intentional chit-chat. And we all say, hi, how are you, blah, blah, blah. But to really pause for a moment with the person on the phone or the person you're looking at, the cashier, and say, how are you feeling today? But, and we know the difference when it's just, how are you? And how are you feeling today? And to give them a moment to be seen and listened to. And again, you walk away from that going, that adds up. That's like, you know, if we had a kindness bank, a liking ourselves more bank, that those are the things that at some point we go, wow, this, my life feels better because of that, you know?
So speaking on that kindness bank, what, I mean, obviously I'm not speaking from a religious point of view, but what is your opinion on karma then?
Karma?
Yeah.
I think it's a valuable thing, first of all, whether it's real or whether it's an idea. Okay? In that I'm not talking about the karma of the suffering that I'm experiencing now as punishment for my past life. I don't think there's a great value in that. That's like just regret, you know. But of looking at, well, what if I did come back? You know, am I doing a good job now? Or am I just trying to get by and go through it as fast as I can, take care of only myself, take advantage of other people? Am I really, if I really think deeply inside, what would, if, in my ideal sense of myself, who would I like to be and what would it look like? And am I doing that? And I think, because if we talk about karma as cycles of life that we return to repair the things from the past life, that so then I need to live a better life. And to me, that's at the basis of it, that I think any religion, any spiritual teaching, because if you read the different religions and spiritual practices of people, it's the same ideas over and over again. They're modified a little bit. The context looks a little different, but they're all about, and the practices, of course, can be different, but the basic fundamental ideas are the same, whether it's Buddhism or Judaism or Islam or any other religion that I've seen. And yet it doesn't work that way, because a lot of times those things become social clubs, and they're not vehicles for practicing who we are and who we can become and who we can be. And again, it takes work, it takes challenge to do that, you know, to do anything. Well, here, I don't, maybe this story will relate to it. So, you know, my work training people to become Feldenkrais practitioners, I often will get someone will contact me. It could be one of my graduates or another practitioner from another training. And this is how the conversation goes. They say, you know, my practice isn't what I'd like it to be. And I say, okay, so we start discussing it. Have you tried this? Yeah. Have you tried this? Yeah. Have you tried this? No. Try that and come, let's see what it goes. And usually 3 months, 4 months later, they call me again. Well, I've been doing that and it's still not what I want it to be. So same conversation. Have you tried this? Yeah, this, yeah, this, no. Try that. And with that goes you like 3 or 4 rounds usually, and it always ends up in the same place, where the fourth round, I say, have you tried this? And they say, oh, I'm not comfortable doing that. And what's really interesting is the ones who do it, their practice takes off. And the ones who don't, stays the same. So, you know, it's like, how do we be comfortable being a little uncomfortable, you know? It's like in the movement work that I teach, the primary focus for most in the beginning is to get more comfortable, right? If I asked you the question, like in your life, what are the times of the day where you're given permission? Or let me ask it another way. When do you get comfortable?
That's a hard question.
You think so? Yeah.
Yeah. I guess when I'm by myself, and just because usually my I go from obviously going from home, I've got like five people in the morning, and then when I get to work, it's all by myself. So it's like a smooth train of thought, and I'm, you know, classically overstimulated. So
right.
Those, you know, when I get there in the morning, I'll do a little walk, just like, you know, one train of thought.
Then interrupt you. So that's kind of how you get comfortable. But I'm asking the question, what's the motivator for you to go, I need to get comfortable?
That's the hardest part, isn't it?
I think it's a simple question. I think it's, or at least for most people, it could be a hard, it is a serious question for sure. But for most people, they get comfortable when they feel uncomfortable.
See, I feel like that's the hardest part for anyone, is to have a self-reflective moment in the moment. You know, like, and we haven't talked about this, but like when you get angry with someone, like how do you realign yourself and check yourself when you're in the like chemical moment where you've got all these receptors just firing, or you know what I mean? Like, it's so hard to, in the end, we're animals, and like we're gonna have those moments where, and it's really us fighting ourselves, being angry. Like, we're so naturally made to feel angry, and that's how we survived, you know, like fighting off saber-toothed tigers and all these people, is like we had to be. Whereas nowadays, we're just like, especially nowadays where everything is digitalized and recorded. And I was going to ask you this question, like, you made a book on kindness. How often do people check you and your actions on kindness? Do you feel if I made a book on kindness, like, people would, like, for example, my wife, and I don't know if you take medicine or anything like that, but
luckily.
I used to take, and I don't take it anymore just for the sake of like going to bed on time, but I used to take ADHD medicine, and I don't take it anymore. And the question that irritates everyone is, have you taken your medicine? You know what I mean? And it's just like, you know, like, that's like a huge, it used to be a huge trigger for me. And I would just like, you know, like, I wouldn't get angry, but it would just be something like, but the funny thing is, that's when you check yourself. Like, that type of statement is like when you realize yourself in the moment. And it's funny.
Let me sort of work our way back a little bit. So, you know, having written this book, like, where does that place me in the world? Like, am I like an expert on kindness? I'm glad you asked that question, because so few people ask that question, right? You know, it's like, are you kind? I'm like, well, I'm doing the best I can, and I'm still learning a lot. And like I said before, each step for me to be kinder is a bigger hurdle. The rung on the ladder is like further away. I'm like, whoa, all the things in the book that I write about, I can do that. I feel successful at that. But the next ones, I hope I live long enough. You know, that's the feeling I have. And in terms of that moment where you can become self-reflective, right? So I agree. And I think that's one of the hardest things. Actually, it's a topic that I've been thinking about for a long time for another book, right? Because in order to change my behavior, whether it's anger or comfort or discomfort or listening, I have to catch myself doing something. And so then we're talking about awareness and attention. So what are the triggers that go, oh, I'm doing that? So if I'm not a self-reflective person, if I don't, would I even be interested in this conversation? It's like, oh, let's change the channel, you know, something else, right? And in terms of, I'm going to go back to comfort and then come back to anger, okay? So comfort, if what I'm saying is accurate, that people get comfortable when they're uncomfortable. So there, we're in the experience of something that's sensory. It could be a discomfort in a muscle, in my back, pain. It could be discomfort emotionally, where I have to either change the conversation, remove myself from the conversation. But whatever that is, the fact that we wait till we're uncomfortable to get comfortable, that's crazy. Kids don't do that. Kids sense themselves all the time. And the moment they're a little uncomfortable, they adapt, they adjust themselves. They won't tolerate it for long. And then we learn as kids and then young adults and as adults to ignore ourselves, to not pay attention to both physical sensations and the emotional sensations, until the point where we're trapped in all these habits that we don't know how to get out of, right? So when I think of being uncomfortable, I'm talking about the physical sensation, and that's something, again, that's concrete in the moment that we can change, that we can do something about. Now, anger is a bigger thing, because really, if I examine what a feeling is, it's, from my point of view, a feeling is a complex of sensations within a particular context. And I'll give you some examples. So let's say you're a passenger in a car and the driver is a complete raving maniac. And they're coming onto two wheels and they're hitting things and going through lights. And what are you doing? You're holding on as tight as you can. Your heart's racing. You're sweating. You're screaming. And what are you feeling? The feeling is fear, right? But now imagine this. You pay $50 to go on this great roller coaster. And what are you doing? You're holding on as tight as you can. You're sweating. Your pulse is rushing. You're screaming. And you're having the best time of your life. So it's the same sensations in a different context. So I would say the more we understand ourselves on a sensory level, in terms of feeling ourselves, the more easily we can recognize the feelings that we have. Because the feelings that we have, we recognize them in a certain point, but they're cooking before that, you know? So maybe we can lower the threshold by sensing ourselves more accurately, by saying, I'm going to pay attention to when I'm comfortable and when I'm uncomfortable. And even if I'm comfortable, can I get a little more comfortable? Or I'm going to move in a way that I like the way it feels. Just going from my desk to the toilet. Not all day long. I'm not talking about dancing through the day or something silly like that. But to mark times to go, I'm going to pay attention to myself in these ways so that that trigger that wakes me up to what's happening develops more and more. I become more sensitive to myself for doing something like that. And then I would say, as another note on kindness, again, if I relate it to movement and action, so to really understand a movement, to really understand it, it needs to be reversible. Can I get in and out of a chair? And the funny thing about reversibility is that in order to reverse something, you have to stop and then reverse it. You're in your car, if you have a, no one has a manual anymore, but if you had a manual, even an automatic, you stop before you put it into reverse. That stopping is the trigger that we're talking about that wakes me up to something, to do something different. And so if in movement, reversibility is a really useful way of describing how we understand a movement, then if I'm angry, I can ask myself the question, can I not be angry? I do that all the time. And most of the time I can go, yeah, I cannot be angry. And then the whole perspective changes on what I'm dealing with. What's the point of being upset with this? I mean, it's like, just what do we need to get done here? What are we going to do? But sometimes I get a little full of myself and I go, yeah, I cannot be angry, but I want to be angry, right? And then I can't sustain that for very long, though, you know? But all of this that we're talking about is, for me, the most fundamental part of any of the things that we're talking about is the practice of it, which the real kicker is then that I have to get angry more to discover how not to be angry. I can't just decide, okay, I'm not going to be angry anymore, and then boom, I lose my temper. You know, it's like I was saying, and when I'm teaching, each time someone comes and gives me another challenging situation, Ah, there it is. Something else is coming again. I have to learn to do that. And eventually, maybe even in the new situations, I stay calmer and I don't react as much. I can respond more. And I do both still.
No, that's great. Because I mean, I think I heard something that was like some boss kept on had a employee keep coming to him with problems, and no matter what, the boss was like good, even no matter how bad the problems were, because obviously if they don't have any problems, they don't have, you know what I mean? Like it's not that it's not interesting. You just get more durability. You know what I mean? Like the other thing is like it. Obviously problems bring, you know, like anger and all this other stuff and like difficulty, but at that point, like, does anyone want to go to a job where, and maybe some people do, where every day is exactly the same? Yeah. For me as a person, that would it bothers me, especially like it bothers me when people at work say the same thing to me every day, like like obviously how your day is going is the same thing, but
right.
If they say like additional lines to me every single day, it just feels, you know, like monotonous.
Yeah. It's not, it doesn't feel authentic anymore.
Exactly. And yeah. I think that's one of the biggest things is the fact that if we were to just do that, we would just be the same person, just revolving and revolving in the same place, not changing. And it's funny that you mentioned that in order to practice dealing with anger, you have to get angry.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a...
Who wants that?
Yeah, exactly. But how do you really... It's like EMTs and all these other people. How do you really prepare an emergency, unless it's an actual emergency? Obviously they go through drills, they go through all this stuff, but you know, nobody can really prepare for the real thing because it's not the real thing.
But you know what you're describing is any study at all. If you're an actor, if you're an engineer, if you're a doctor, the preparation is the attempt to give you enough potential choices so when a situation comes up, you know what to do. You know, the last place you want to be is in the coffee break room with new doctors, because they're all going, oh my god, I thought they were going to die, I didn't know what to do, and it was crazy, you know. And it's like a lawyer, everyone starts out going through a course of study about something, but then it's when you do it. And you know what, it's the same thing with kindness, that you have to practice it, that it's not something that you study, you read about. I mean, look, so many people ask me, is your book about compassion and empathy? And I say, well, of course, but really it's about concrete things you can practice every day to generate more of this. And the concrete things are approachable things, possible things, not something so big like, I'm just going to be kind to everybody I meet today. That's too big, you know? Just make it small. Practice something small and see how it develops and grows. Because if you can gain the skill around the small action, it can build a little bit more and a little bit more until one day, you know, I have some consistency in this. And maybe the worst thing is, like, here's something I notice in myself, is that the moments when I don't act kindly. Now, here's the other thing. When I catch myself not succeeding in the act of kindness, when I catch myself having been angry and not being able to reverse it in any way, I don't spend as much time going through the whole thing because I can't change that, right? I can just go, oh, I did that again. Okay, instead of, oh, Alan, I can't believe you did that again. This guy's going to interview. He's going to ask you, I'm back and I'm bad as everyone else. No likes on Facebook. What's wrong with me, right? As opposed to, oh, yeah, I did it again. But now instead of dwelling on it for a day, maybe it's an hour or 10 minutes, you know? So it's like, huh, what do I do next? How do I move on, right? Because I don't believe I don't believe in my lifetime, and I haven't met anyone, I don't think, maybe a couple of people who are beyond that, right? Who don't get angry anymore. And if you did, wouldn't you want to test it?
Yeah, like what their
button is, you know?
Yeah. Like for example, I think the triggers I have they're mostly my parents. I mean, other family. Than that, yeah. Like, because I mean, like, they were there during the creation of you. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
when you're learning stages and all this, so they know, like, they should know. You know what I mean? Like, they've known me for the longest time, so they should know that. But I mean, that's multiple layers. But I
would say that the practice of almost anything with the people we're closest to is the hardest. Whether it's, we're talking about emotional level, if you're a lawyer doing law for your parent, oh my God, or doctors don't work with their families, right? They're like, no, that's hard to do, you know? But I think it can change. I think it can change, but so, you know, my mother passed away when I was young. And a couple of years later, I was at my dad's house watching TV, and, you know, we're lying there. And I realized, you know, I never told my dad, I never really tell my dad that I love him. And you know, he was kind of a shut down dad who didn't talk about his feelings and stuff. And typical, I think, in many families. And I decided I was going to tell him I love him. So we're watching TV and a commercial comes on, and I went, Dad, I want you to know that I love you. And he went, I love you too. What's on Channel 4? What's on Channel 7? And I was like mortified. I was like, oh my God, I just bared my soul to this guy. And he just changed the channel to respond. And I'm lying there for half an hour fuming, hurt and angry. And then the thought entered my head was, wait a minute, I did this because I wanted to say this to him, not because I'd get something back. And that quieted me down. And then the funny thing was, I kept saying it. So I'd be away, I'd be on the phone, I'd say, all right, Doc, I love you, hang up. And I don't know, maybe a year later, I was on the phone with him, and I said, I love you, and he went, I love you too, and he hung up, and I'm, what? Did he really say that? And then he started saying it. So, you know, it's our parents, you know, we can describe it in terms of how they are towards me and like my expectation for them to change. That's, I think, that's a forever battle. I can change. I don't react when they do something to me. You know, I just listen and go, oh, you know, maybe I can hear what they're saying. Like my mother, you know, I grew up, we weren't religious, but we were Jewish, right? So I had a real Jewish mother. So I was at university and my mother called me one day and she said, why haven't you called me? And I was like, what? I spoke to you yesterday. And she said, but I called you. Why haven't you called me? It's crazy, you know? And I remember thinking, oh, this means she loves me, right? Instead of, because I could have gotten angry, like, what are you talking about? You're crazy, but I'm not, right? But I went, oh, she's expressing a need that she has for me to call her. Okay. I don't remember if I did it. I don't think I did it more, but at least I didn't react in that way, you know? So our parents can change, but we have to be the vehicle for change. We change our behavior, not to change them. In the same way, when I talk about being kind to ourselves, like most of us, we're in a relationship and sometimes we just wish the other person would do blah, blah, blah. Make me coffee in the morning once in a while. I always make you coffee. And instead of waiting for them or telling them that they're wrong for not making coffee, to say, you know what? I can make my own coffee. I can take care of myself. And then maybe I even get to the point where I'm not only going to make me coffee, I'm going to make them coffee every morning. And not spitefully, not to like I'm doing this to get something back, right? But to cleanly do it. And the other person doesn't know what to do with that. You know, that they're like, that makes them change more than anything. Or not, right?
Well, the other thing is that you mentioned it that way is I think we, we sometimes we think we're the main character, and that we like the way you describe the coffee part. It's like, why they never make me coffee? And it's like, you think this world runs around you, so you think that that's even like a thought in their mind. You know what I mean? Like, what if you if you really wanted it, you've got to speak it out loud.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like that might be like when they first wake up, that's not a thing that they think about. Maybe they don't run on coffee. They're not like me and my wife. Like coffee is not a thing that's in their radar. That's something you have to make where, like some people, just like you were saying earlier, some people are receptive of people, or children are receptive of people's feelings and stuff like that when they come into a room. I know I am, just because growing up, you had to feel the room when you walked in.
Uh-huh.
Like it wasn't like a type of deal where, like, you know, you walked in and it was always welcome. You had to feel the pressure. You had to know what was going on in the room. It wasn't something where, you know, you had to, you know, understand what was going on and then adapt to it.
Sure.
But yeah.
You know, there's a Rumi quote that I like that a girlfriend of mine once gave to me, not in the kindest way, because the quote is, I think it's something like, when you walk into a room, wake up. It's like, see what's going, because I used to just, she'd be working in her office and I would just barge in talking, you know, and she'd be like, the door's closed, knock, you know, or, you know, and then she told me that quote and it was like, it was a little passive aggressive, but I got it. You know, it was like, oh, and you know what? It took me, I had to practice that, right? And I still have to, if I'm really enthusiastic about something, I have to go, wait, because I still bump into people. It's from a good intention, right? So it's not like a hostile thing or anything like that. A good intention, both on my part, my enthusiasm, and her part, educating me in some way. That's what we need to do. So.
No, that's great. And so before our last question, what is something that you hope that you're, like, for your book, what is one big thing that you hope people get from reading the book?
Oh, well, I hope at the very least, it plants the seeds, two seeds. So I'm going to say two things. One seed that can develop from that point on to the rest of their life, that they can find more and more ways to like themselves more. And the other seed connected to that is that it's a seed that grows to generate more and more kindness towards themselves and others. Because I think that if the world's in a, it seems to all of us like in a wild place, but it's not going to start big. It's going to start with each of us, you know, and if each of us can change ourselves for the better like that, I think there's a, hopefully there'll be a tipping point for the world.
Oh, that's great. I like that. So to our last question.
Yeah.
What is something that your parents did that you'd like to pass on to the next generation? And what is something new or different that they necessarily wouldn't have done?
So let me do the first one first. I might ask the second question again. When my mother died when I was young, like I said, and she was a painter. And we found among her belongings that she had actually destroyed most of her artwork. There were a few things left. But we found a letter that she had written to us when we were like 8 and 10 years old, my brother and I. And in it, she talks about art and beauty, and she also talks about truth. And she said, I don't know if telling someone the truth is the best thing. But if it's going to hurt you not to tell the truth, then you need to tell the truth. So that's always stayed with me. And the idea that to not be honest, and I'm making a strong distinction between telling the truth and criticizing, they're not the same thing. That if it's hurting me to not be honest in a situation, that's not good. So that each of us needs to know ourselves well enough to know that I need to act on this. I can't let it go. So to take action in support of our own well-being. So I would say that. And then the second question, well, I guess I wish they had more of both an understanding and a desire to understand more what it meant to be a family. Because I think back then it was just like, oh, we were kids, they were the parents, we did our things, that was that. There wasn't, I have friends now, young kids and stuff, and I see how engaged they are in their lives. So maybe that's it, that they would have been more engaged in mine and my brother's lives, as opposed to being in opposition to so many things that we did. You know, so maybe greater support. I don't think that's new, but I think that's essential.
Yeah, no, I like that. Kind of what we talked about a lot is perspective, basically, because, you know, like sometimes your parents, and it's funny because I have kids now. So you kind of think, I think forward and I think backward. Like when my parents are talking to me, I just imagine like how I talk to my son's, he's like 3 years old. So it's like, I have to understand how they see me. Right. Because I have to see how I see my son. And it's funny, like I look that way, then I've got to look back. Like I've got to treat him. Like kids are really just adults that don't know the rules yet. Because they still operate, like, you know, chemically the same way as we do. They just don't know, like, you know, don't run in the street. Or like all this, like emotional rules. Like, if I were, and it's, like I said, it's, nothing with any, well, some parents, obviously, they're horrible to their kids. There's some extreme cases, but in retrospect, they were just not parented. And it's just the vicious cycle where it's really not their fault. Like, for example, my parents, we didn't, just like you said, we didn't talk about feelings or anything like that. And it's not their fault because their parents didn't talk about feelings. But nowadays, when I talk to my son, I, like, if he hits me or something, I'm like, hey, that wasn't, like, I tell him how I'm feeling, like a cause and effect type relationship where, you know, nowadays, if I tell that, obviously my parents aren't hitting me right now, but if they say something to me, to be fair, like, I'm not going to tell them how I'm feeling, which is kind of not sticking to the way I want to parent, which is the part that I need to work on.
That's right. Because in my book, I mention a body of work called nonviolent communication, developed by this man named Marshall Rosenberg, and it's pretty genius. He's not alive anymore, but he spent a lot of his life mediating between like different countries and warring factions, different groups, and really serious stuff. And he has some really brilliant ideas about communication, especially like around your parent. Like when you say you don't share your feelings, what would it be like if you did? What's the worst that's going to happen? Like they shut you down? Okay. They've done that already. You're already shut down. You're not sharing your feelings. Do it again. But then we have to understand how to share our feelings so that it's not about them. Right? It's like instead of saying, you know, I feel so hurt by you. That's not a feeling. That's telling them what they're doing wrong, right? I can say, I feel sad that I don't have this in my life, something I want, not something they need to do. And they can give it or not. And it may take many times, like practice again, to do that. And then, oh, you're talking about your feelings again. Great. And I said, well, yeah, I'm going to keep doing that. Oh, it's okay. You know, practice it. See what helps. See if that changes it. Right.
Yeah, no, okay. That's great. And before I forget, where you can find your book on Amazon, correct?
Yeah, Amazon, Practice Intentional Acts of Kindness and Like Yourself More. And it's a paperback, and it's, I like to say, a Kindle. and it's also an audiobook too.
Okay, awesome. And is there anything else you're working on that you'd want to tell listeners about?
No, I think that's the major thing. I mean, if they're interested in the work, my other work, the Feldenkrais Method, I have another website called uncommonsensing.com, And that's probably a better, if people are interested, that's if there's free downloads and stuff, you can try it.
Okay.
And see what this is like.
And I'll put that up with the episode people listening so they can check that out as well. But thank you very much for being on the show, Alan. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, and I really enjoyed our conversation.
If you liked this week's episode of People More Interesting Than Me, please follow me on Apple Podcasts so you won't miss out on more episodes like these.